There's a lot of snow here, Sarah.
Oh, God, yeah. I've been reading about Chicago.
You're like, oh.
We don't get that here. I keep wishing for snow. I'm like, the New Englander in me, and you must feel this way from Ohio, like, God, I love a snow day.
Yeah.
Even though I don't get a snow, I mean.
Right, sure, you can give yourself a snow day.
Guess what, everybody? My job is 10 feet from my bed. So I have to go to work whether or not there's snow, but man, I love a like big snow.
Yeah, it's actually been really pretty.
Yeah, I love that first big snow. And we just don't get it as much as we used to.
No, so we got maybe like 6 or 8 inches last week, and then it stayed cold, so the snow's still on the ground. And then we probably got 3 or 4 inches overnight. So it's really very pretty outside right now.
Yeah. I do, because, you know, city snow.
Sure.
You get like 40 minutes.
And then it turns like, into like, ugh. Yeah.
But it's nice when it refreshes.
Yeah. Well, and I like live close to like big parks and like sort of open areas and like the lake. And by work, I work by Lincoln Park. So, I mean, it is, I will say, then you kind of be like, all right, this isn't just, you know, terrible black slush on the side of the road. But I will say I see people riding their bikes and I really am scared for them because it is the thing that's really dangerous. It's like, you know, black ice, right? So it's like it melts a little and then there's just like water on the surface of the road or the sidewalk.
And then it gets and slick it freezes.
And then, you know, and I do. I worry about people. So I hope everyone is being safe. And the
you're
drivers.
Just shouting out your window, make good choices.
Well, mostly it's I worry about cars, right? I mean, these people know, the bikers know what they're doing. It's the people recklessly driving around them that scare me. So,
yeah. That is the one thing. I mean, as everybody knows, I was in Copenhagen. I was in Denmark and Sweden in the fall. And in Copenhagen, especially, it's like a bike city.
Yeah.
And like, I would say half, something like half of all people like commute to work on bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And it really just underscores how incredibly car reliant we are. Because they are so, everybody's, it's like bike first there.
Yeah.
And everybody's so safe and they're all, it seems very scary. And we didn't do it because I was like, I feel like we would cause a bike wreck, like just not knowing all of the rules of this. But yeah, I wish that more cities were really committed to bike lanes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we're getting better and better about that here. But in fact, do you have city bikes in Chicago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we have, so for those of you who don't live in cities, there is this like
bike
it's
share.
It's basically like a bike share. And there are all over the city, there are like pods of maybe 10 bikes like locked in. And you just, I think, like scan your app and then like city bike to like take your bike to wherever you're going and then drop it in a pod near where you are. We just got a city bike pod at the end of our block, so.
That is nice, yeah. There's one at the end of my block, too, and I think it's mostly, like, a summer thing. My work is too far to bike to. I mean, I think.
I mean, true bikers would be, like.
True bikers would be, like, fine.
I'm happy to bike there. It's also freezing.
Well, I mean, this time of year, but even when it's nice. The problem with, like, biking on the lake is the wind. Right.
So I mean, blow right over.
Yeah. So from my neighborhood, from Hyde Park to like Soldier Field is, I think, maybe, I don't know, like 5 or 7 miles. Right. So you can like bike up there and then like turn around and bike back. And it's like, you know, a good ride or whatever. And there was a time, this is like a couple summers ago, where I like biked. That's probably like the farthest I'll go just on the lakefront path, because then you're like, you get like really hit a lot of pedestrians and stuff. So anyway, I biked up there and it was like, I don't know how long that would take me. I don't remember. And then like I turned around and I was riding directly into the wind, and it took me essentially like double the time it took me to get up there to get home. And and you're just like, oh. So, I mean, that's the part you like kind of can't account for, is just how intense that all is anyway. Also now that it's freezing. Although, as I like to tell people, no matter how cold it is, I don't care how cold it is. I have never been like, because I drive up Lakeshore Drive to get to work. There's never been a day where I have not seen at least one person out there walking or running.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Most people are.
Yeah. But, like, so some hardcore assholes, like, minus 20, I don't care.
I like how you call them hardcore assholes.
Because it's seriously, I'm like, well, I mean, the other
thing. If you are a hardcore asshole, please know that Jen said that and not Sarah.
Listen, again, I worry about these people because when it is that cold.
Be safe with your lungs and your heart.
And the lake will sweep you away. Like, I'm not even kidding.
So the lake does not freeze, right? Because it has a tide.
It can freeze.
Everyone, welcome to Faded Mates. I'm Sarah McLean. I read romance novels and I write them. And yeah, we're just interested in bodies of water today.
And other bodies. I'm Jennifer Prokop, a romance reader and editor. Yes, the lake can freeze along the edges. And it's actually interesting. Like, so it has to be really cold for a really long time. And like the surface of the lake will freeze, but it won't freeze.
It's not like you can ice fish.
These lakes are too big.
I'm going to wait, you guys. So we all know that if you listened last week, you know that I have been, my social media has been locked down. So now I really have to like think carefully about at what point I'm going to get on social media and for how long. It's stressful here. And this week I did see a video that was of a like city council meeting somewhere in Michigan about allowing ice fishing on like a local lake.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen this video?
No.
And it's like a classic elderly gray-haired white man.
Sure.
On city council, who has the microphone, and he is the like city councilman, and he is like, my concern about allowing ice fishing on this lake is that once we allow ice fishing, like, where does it end? Because then are we going to have to allow ice huts on the lake? And you know that, you know, if we allow ice fishing and then we end up allowing ice huts, that leads to its natural conclusion, prostitution.
What?
And it's like, how is this? And the like long lie, the long pause before, and I'm like, what's he gonna say? What is the natural, like, what's he gonna say? Like, are people gonna die? Like, fall through the ice? Like, are we gonna need more emergency services? Apparently it's prostitution. And now listen, everybody, I'm going to find that video and we're going to put it in show notes because...
Talk about a hardcore asshole, right?
I mean, and what's amazing is it cuts off like kind of right after there. And I'm like, what is the response to this?
Do you think he was joking? Like, and then he was like, oh, no, I'm just kidding.
This man has never told a joke in his life. I don't know where he is or who he is, but I know he's never told a joke in his life. Anyway, I will find that. And that leads me to, Eric asked me to do a little housekeeping today. Everyone.
A very natural
sex work leads me to Eric, my husband, telling me to do some housekeeping. But listen, he asked me to let everybody know that if you have noticed that the chapter images are missing from your podcasting app, we are aware that there is some kind of problem. We've been, and I will say Eric, not we.
Yeah, not we.
Eric has spent like literally daily, he has been in conversation with our podcast host people, trying to figure out what the problem is. Apparently they are showing in some apps, but they're not showing in every app. And we know, and we're trying to fix it because we also know, apparently, basically like 1% of all podcasts use that feature.
Yes. And we've been doing it since the beginning.
We've been using it since the beginning. And what's interesting is that at our old, we used to host somewhere else, and at our old place, they were like fascinated by us. and now this new place is like,
nobody
wants
like that.
You're like 1% of people. But Eric's really sad about it, and by extension, we care about it. And if you too are sad about it, just know he sees you. Like, recognizes like.
All right. For those of you who are still using Spotify, and I will admit to being in that like kind of shameful group, fine. You get like Spotify Wrapped, right? So at the end of the year, it tells you like all this stuff about you. And like the, you know, humiliating thing this year is it told me how like my listening age was 66. And I was like, fuck you. And
pardon me.
I went through a Pink Floyd phase earlier in the year. And they were like, bitch, you're old.
Listen, that Dark Side of the Moon album, it slaps.
It slaps you into being 66 on Spotify. So just... But then this part's really funny. Okay, so everybody knows we have a Discord, and our Discord is hopping, right? And I kind of was like, yeah, I'm in another really big, busy Discord.
You can join it at fadamates.net/Patreon.
Yes, you can also give it as a gift, right, to someone.
fadamates.net/gift.
Okay. So here's the part. Apparently Discord now will give you like your Discord stats, okay? And I can't remember what it's called, countdown or something, whatever.
Yeah, somebody told me I had to look for it, and I was like, I can't find that.
You're like, that's simply not my business, right? Okay. You have to update your app, I will say. That's what did it for me.
Is that what the issue is?
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing. It tells you like, okay, you've made however many, you know, like comments or whatever, that puts you in, and then it gives you like a percentage of Discord users. So we have all these people on our Discord that's like, and even like top, I was like 6%, top, you know, 6%. And I was like, they just mean like in our Discord. Bitch, no, they mean in Discord.
No.
And I was
you're in the top 6% of commenters in all of Discord, or our Discord is?
All these people in our Discord have numbers like mine that are like, and I was just like, oh,
this
God.
Is amazing. This is because romance readers are.
They want to talk about.
I mean, honestly, unique and special in a lot of ways.
Yes. I was like, listen, come on. They cannot possibly mean.
We love you all very, very much.
Yeah. They do mean all of this.
I love that the Discord is always hopping. I also just want to give a shout out to the Discord because there's all sorts of like listening. Listen, there. This is not just a community for romance readers anymore. Like,
oh yeah, it's become
a community for romance readers. But there are tags about people who like exercising.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
stuff about. There's like a whole channel on
gardening,
parenting,
cooking.
On gardening, on food. And I will say that I slid into the parenting channel the other day because I think I mentioned this, but I did one of these. I did a couple of like angel gift things for an organization here in New York City. And I was assigned 2 17-year-old boys. Mm. And I was like,
what do I get them?
Yeah. This is like a you know, I don't know what this is. You might as well have told me I was assigned a blue monkey. Like, I don't know. And so I went on there and I was like, help. Like, what do I give to 2 17-year-old boys that I don't know? And people were really helpful. And especially because when you're doing one of these angel gift things, you don't know, like, what a 17-year-old boy has or doesn't have. Like, you don't know if they have access, if they're housed. Like, you don't know sort of
anything,
a lot of the pieces of the puzzle. And so I just want to shout out that part of the Discord because people were really helpful.
Yeah. No, it's honestly amazing. But yeah, it's like a full service Discord at this point, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it just really, I was like, they can't possibly mean like Discord. And I was like, oh, they mean Discord. So anyway, the other thing that has been really nice for me, I will mention, is I have jumped on the Heated Rivalry TV show train.
Oh, which, yeah, you're in it now.
Yeah, I mean, and here's my thing, like what I had forgot. So one of the reasons that I'm a very I would like to watch 1 hour of TV a week at most. And so in the era of streaming, I am really outside of like the bounds of how most people watch TV, and I just like lose track of them really quickly. Even like Bridgerton, which is like something I probably should have really been like on board with, like it just drops all at once and I get like, I'm like overwhelmed, I can't do it, right? So, but this, I was like, oh, it's like one episode a week. And then, you know, what is really fun is like there's a whole Heated Rivalry channel. And so it just is kind of like water cooler. I've been calling it Discord cooler, right? Where you can actually have that like sort of old school experience of kind of like everybody watching it. And then the next day or two, just like chit chatting about it and what they thought and what they noticed. And I do think that it is a rewarding way to watch a television show, right? Like, mm-hmm. just as opposed to just like gulping it all down all at once. I would like to gulp down a romance novel all at once, but I'm really okay with like sort of the pace of, you know, this show. And so, and I like the sort of pleasant buzz of being like, oh yeah, there'll be another one coming in a week or whatever. So anyway, that has been really fun, but also that's why I was like, no wonder this place is hopping. It's like literally everybody in here is like top 10% of Discord users. We're just in here all the time chatting.
Exactly.
It's really fun. This week's episode of Faded Mates is brought to you by Zara Doyle, author of Bianca and Her Wolf.
We love a fated mate story here at Fated Mates, and we love it even better if they're resistant to the whole thing. And that is what we've got going on in the fourth of the New York City Werewolves series. Bianca, our heroine, has known that she was fated mates with Mike, our hero, for more than 9 years. Problem is, back in the day, Mike brutally betrayed her and she refuses to forgive him. She refuses to do a lot of things, including feel feelings and cry, but Mike can always get under her skin. And now that skin is even thinner than usual because her mother has died and he is back in town at her mother's funeral because he's responsible and he's respectable and he knows how to be a good mate. And Bianca doesn't believe it, but she does wish that he didn't smell so good and she does wish that he didn't look so good. She's busy. She has a job. She has a life. And now she has to clear out her mother's home, which is full of stuff and also memories. And every time she looks outside, Mike's just there, standing, hands in his pockets, waiting for his mate to come to him.
Well, I hope that he continues to suffer because that's the kind of reader I am. But I'm sure it will work out for these two crazy kids in the end. Keep an eye on your content warning for this one. Although this is a book in the New York City Werewolf series and a standalone, it is enemies to lovers, love triangle, age gap. But there's definitely a lot of stuff happening in their past that you might want to know about. So it is available in print, ebook, and with your monthly subscription to Kindle Unlimited. And if your podcasting app supports it, you can click on the chapter title right now to be taken to buy the book. Thanks to Zara Doyle for sponsoring this week's episode.
Let's talk about the book box, Jen.
Okay, well, because I got mine and it was awesome. So
yes,
as you know, everybody, we have a best of 2025 list, right? Our favorite 10 romances of the year, and our friends at Pocket Books in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, have put together a box where you can get 8 of those 10 books, 2 of the ones that are like sort of self-published are not in the box. So you get sort of all 8. You can also do an add-on, right? Like any romances they have in the store, they have some of their favorites listed. And so you can just really get like essentially this awesome box. And the total price of the box ends up being like 25% off of like what these books would be in the store. So for 8 books, it's like a totally great price. And then you can do what I do, which is like, you know, so some of them I wanted to keep for like my keeper shelf. Some of them, you know, I already had copies of. But like this week, it was actually really funny. I brought all, like sort of some of the extras and then like other books that I had that I wasn't going to keep to work. And I took a picture of them and then I sent it out to like my romance reading friends at school with like a little like, and then I did like a little like come and get them. And then for each book, I did like a little like, hey, here's what this one's about. Just like a sentence. And it was so fun. And like by the end of the day, all the books were gone. And it was really great.
That is really, really fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. And so, you know, then I got to sort of like, you know, talk it up to people and, you know, give them. And then I'm also putting like my romance reader friends at work in contact with each other because one woman her name is Sarah. She actually is one of the teachers. She was at Fated Mates Live with my other friend Elizabeth last summer. She was really interested in Anne of Avenue A, which I had a copy of and was like giving away because it was great and I loved it. But I was also like, it's a Christmas book. Let me share the love. And she was really interested in that one because it was a, you know, a Jane Austen retelling. And so I was like, well, just reply to everybody and be like, who has this one? When you're done with it, like pass it back to me. So anyway, this book box at Pocket Books is terrific. And I just think it's a great way for you to get like books, these awesome books that, you know, maybe you have heard us talk about. And it's a great gift for yourself or for others, or even a great gift that you can like split up, keep some of them, give some of them away. We really hope that you will check it out. They have sold quite a few of them, but they do still have some left in stock. And given that it's December 9th or 10th or whatever today, you know, this should be hopefully time for you to get it for your cozy winter reading plans.
That's right. I always wrap a bunch of them up and put them in my little free library, like as a
so fun,
You know,
yeah,
blind date with a book thing. This holiday, and I always feel like they go right away. And often I think, are people taking them out of here and then like passing them on as gifts to other people? In which case,
have at it. Good job.
Have a great time, everybody.
Yeah. What do I care?
I always imagine, like, I wonder if there's, like, in my head, it's always a boy headed by, and they realize they, like, didn't pick up a gift for their mom.
And then they're like, here's Son of the Morning. I'm not sure what it's about, Mom.
And here I am just delivering them.
Amazing. That's awesome. I love it. So yeah, just please check out Pocketbooks, and you can look at that list and see what's on it if you go to Faded Mates Best Of. And then I think there's a link there that will take you to Pocketbooks, and then you can just click on their site. I think it's really easy to navigate to. I think nice. It's like book boxes or something. So,
well, that's that. We've gotten through, you know, we've talked about Bodies of Water. We've talked about the chapter images. We've talked about the book box.
So, yeah, we're going to stop talking about Bodies of Water and start talking about birds.
Birds. Who could have imagined that birds would be so sexy? We'll get there.
We'll get there. It's like wildlife time. Oh, my God. You guys, last week, when were you talking about squirrels? And I sent you and Eric that video of that squirrel. You didn't even reply.
Wait, really? I don't think I got it. Was I able to get onto it?
I have no idea.
Is it possible you sent it while I was under lockdown?
I was walking. Oh, I don't know. No, it's like in your text. So anyway, I was walking down the street, everybody, and there was a squirrel. And I was like, city squirrels have zero fear of
new
people.
New listeners are like, what the fuck is this podcast?
You know what? They understand that in December we're a bit distracted. Anyway, so today we will be talking not about squirrels, but about birds. And that is because we are reading The Magpie Lord by K.J. Charles.
Yes. And now listen, Jen, tell me, have you read this book before?
Okay, I have not. In fact, let me tell you, this is one of those books where you're like, I haven't read this book. And so you go to buy it and Amazon is like, you bought this book in 2023.
Yeah, congratulations. Yes. You've owned this book for
years.
Full
yes.
Right. Lifetime.
So I have read quite a few of K.J. Charles' books, but you know what? I have not read this one. And so I was really excited to read this. And this is, like you were saying before we got started, like one of Adriana's favorites. And so it's always really fun to like read obviously reading K.J. Charles is always like bless the authors with the big backlists, right? Because then you just like dive into like a favorite author, like mm-hmm. you know there's something out there you're gonna read and love. But it's always also interesting to be like, why is this someone's favorite? Like, what are the like things about it that make it so great? Now, here is my question, and I don't know if you looked this up. Is this KJ's first book?
Let me look that up. I think it is possible because this book is much older than I thought it was.
Yeah.
It is for sure her most popular book. Like, it is the book everybody talks about.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
Now, everybody should know that K.J. Charles was a trailblazer for us. We've had her on the show to talk about her own life in romance and how she came to write. She is an editor, which is something that I think mm-hmm. is important to sort of think about as you're going through this. She used to work for Mills and Boone. So I think all of that sort of feeds into this, like what this book actually feels like as you're reading it. The answer to you is, I believe this is her first full length book.
Yeah.
She wrote, it looks like, a ton of shorts beforehand, but this looks like it's the first full length. And it's really interesting because I have never read this, and I hadn't read it because I think in my head I was like, I don't know. I knew that it was sort of a series. I knew it. There were, you know, a number of books that were like related to it. And I think in my head, I was just like, I was always like, oh, I don't have time to like start going down this path.
Right.
Even though I have read almost all of KJ's other books. So like, I don't know how it is that I missed this, but I did.
It's interesting because looking at this, I'm like, this is 2013.
Yep.
I mean, and so I know how I missed it because I really did not. Well, I guess that's not true.
I had a baby.
Yeah, you.
That's why I missed
right.
it.
Right. You had a baby.
That'll do it, everybody.
Yeah. I think, like, here's what I would say is, I had a Kindle at that point, but I did not have social media. And so I would say that I was very much still reading essentially like what I could find in a bookstore. And then I was replicating those searches on my Kindle, right? So I could walk into a bookstore and see, you know, there's no reason I wouldn't have. I love a historical, right? And I would have been reading a lot of historicals at that time. But what I would be doing is like going into Barnes and Noble or whatever, because that was probably the only place you could buy a romance in a store at that point. And I'd be like, okay, well, here are the authors I see. And then I would sort of buy some books, but also those would be the authors I was reading. And so, you know, the ecosystem of like what happened to my reading when I got on social media, when I got on Twitter, right? It was life changing just for like the depth and the breadth and like, you know what I mean? The discoverability of it shot through the roof for me. So I think for me, it's really obvious why I had no idea that this had happened, right?
I also feel like I wasn't reading a ton of indie or like small press at the time. Like, you know, by the time in 2013, I had only been publishing for a couple of years. And I think it was maybe 2014 or 2015 when I was like, I'm not reading diversely enough, like widely enough.
Right.
And so I like really, that was the year where I like sat down and I really shifted the way I read to being extremely intentional that year. Mm-hmm. And I did a whole thing where I was like, for every like cishet white romance, I'm going to read something that is
not,
you know, like not. And that work, like it doesn't even, now I look back on it, it never felt like work, but it was like that sort of intentionality in reading, which is something that we talk about all the time whenever anybody says like, well, I don't think about that. I just like read the book that shows up in front of me. And it's like, yeah, that's why you have to think about that. Like you, unless you're reading with intention, you're not going to find, you know, a lot of these books. And I think KJ was one of the first romance writers who was writing queer characters and like the books broke into mainstream. By 2014, 2015, we all knew who KJ was. And like we were all looking at her books and reading them.
Yeah.
But I also think this is one of those situations where, you know, her craft is so tight and her ability to structure a plot is so tight. And I mean, I was reading this and it's really interesting because I was reading this on E and, you know, it shows you the percentage on the bottom. And there's like 10% of this book that I didn't know because I like was reading as I was going, but like this book ends at 90%
right
on your e-reading experience. And it was really funny because I kept sort of like turning points were happening and I was like, this is really interesting. Like this feels like it's happening like kind of later than it should. Like,
yeah, right.
There was a percent. I was like, this is so fascinating. Like, how is this structured? Where is she going to go? Like with 10 more, like 10% more. And then it ended and I was like, oh no, she's perfect.
Yeah.
Like, she hit every beat exactly where it was supposed to be. Like, I feel like this is a masterclass in how to structure a story. And you said it to me because you read this before I did. And you were like, Sarah, it's so fast.
It's so
fast. And I didn't know also. And although I do know she was an editor for Mills and Boone, which is everybody, the original Harlequin of categories. And so like this is category length. And it is paced like a category, like a bullet from a gun.
Boom. So it's just, it's funny. I'm looking at it on Goodreads. So it was originally published in 2013 and it was published by Samhain.
No.
Yes.
This was the like golden age of small press.
Okay. So I can't remember when I like sort of joined. Actually, I can. I would say that I probably joined Romance Twitter in probably 2016-ish. So, and like all of a sudden, like I said, the whole like world was like, so I was like, whoa, right? Like this is all completely insane. Everything that is happening, right? And what I discovered is that there are like several of these like romance small presses that were publishing really interesting books. And Samhain was one of them. And the thing about these books, right, is that they were doing like romance and erotica. They were doing, you know, like really interesting, I mean, like kind of paranormally, right? Like fantasy kind of books like mm-hmm. that. And, you know, but like also essentially they, my understanding is essentially just like shut it down, like boom.
It was a shock. I don't want to tell a story that isn't true, but like yeah. there are a lot of these presses, like they were dominating at the very beginning.
Yes.
Like it was like, you know, everybody always says like, well, it's not 2012 anymore. Like what we mean by that is like in 2012, like there was so little. It felt like there was so much indie available to you. Like there was so much e-only, so much new content on the devices, but it was a fraction of a percent of what there is now.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
So every book, like if you were a writer who could publish, who could write one and who could publish quickly, like you could make a ton of money.
Yeah.
But it was still before indie publishing, like author to market,
yes.
directly to market, had really, really exploded. And I mean, there were some people who were doing it, right? Like Barbara Freely was doing it. Bella Andre was doing it. Like I could name probably 10 people who were self-publishing in like the truest sense of the word. But a lot of these small presses were the middleman. Like you would still write and you would deliver to one of these small presses and they would handle everything, publish it, and then you would make more money on the back end. Like you didn't make an advance, but you make more money on the back end. And then I just think the gates opened and people started to realize like, I can do it myself. Like I don't, you know, writers who were very fast and were like really business-minded understood that they didn't need that middleman. And then these small presses weren't able, they had no ability to sustain their business model. And a lot of them, and I don't know if this is true about Sam Haim, but a lot of them like stopped paying authors.
Yeah.
Like Dream Spinner, right. Like it was bad news when all of these started sort of packing up shop.
This week's episode of Faded Mates is brought to you by Alexandra Kate, author of Storm of Fire.
So Scarlett was locked inside a tower as a young girl. It's giving Rapunzel. Forced to live in isolation until a visit with the devil changed everything. And suddenly, fire begins to shoot from her fingertips, and she has burned down her entire tower.
Amazing.
And is forced to accept a devil's bargain that brings her to be introduced to an entirely new world that she never believed existed. She's in hell, and soon she begins to realize that there is far more to her story than she was told. Hell has been waiting for Scarlett's return ever since she was stolen away and hidden from the devil himself. There is a war coming, and Scarlett is at the center of it. And as more of her magic comes to light and the promise of hell's dragon is revealed to her, Scarlett is forced to learn her role and decide if she is willing to take it on. But a lifetime of solitude in a tower has shaped her to be defiant, miserable, and overwhelmed. And even if it means defying the devil himself and fighting against everything she was told to believe, she is going to do this her way. This is a romance. It's a Hades and Persephone retelling, and Scarlett's hero, Lucien, proves to be pretty sexy and a great partner in whatever crime they get up to.
So if you would like to check out this really fun romance-y that mashes up a Hades and Persephone retelling with Rapunzel, then you should check out Storm of Fire. It is available in ebook or with your monthly subscription to Kindle Unlimited. And if your podcasting app supports it, you can click on the chapter title right now to be taken to buy the book. Thanks to Alexandra Kate for sponsoring this week's episode. The Magpie Lord was the first in like a series that had the same characters, and then there were like kind of a world, right? So like quite a few of KJ's books were with Samhain, and it's really interesting because what it says, like, in the Publisher's Weekly kind of announcement is mm-hmm. that the, like essentially the publisher said that ebook sales had been really declining steadily over the past couple years, and attempts to renegotiate terms with Amazon for better placement on their site have been met with silence. And so this is it, right? As we all know, it's like, right, like, if you can't, if they're not going to put your book, the books, in front of people, you know, in the, like, those algorithmic kind of, like, you know, other people who read this liked or whatever, then it's really hard to, like, find an audience. And so, you know, essentially they shut down and authors got their rights back. And, you know, so there was probably, like, a transition point where you couldn't get the books. And it's just really fascinating to think, like, I will be honest. And I mean, we had KJ on, but we've had a lot of people on, so I'm sorry if KJ probably talked about this. Like, I really don't think I had really, like, realized the extent at which, like, she in particular got caught up in sort of that business, I guess I'll say. So isn't that really interesting? Yeah.
Yeah. And they had Maya Banks, they had Lorelai James, they had Vivian Arend. Like, they had names, like, people who you, who, if you were reading romance at the time, you were reading their books. And I also think, like, listen, KJ clearly knows the score. She knows the way the industry works. Just 5 minutes of our Trailblazer interview, and you know, like, this is not a person who, like, this is a person who chose a small press knowing, like, how it would work. And, I mean, I think Samin did very well for her in the sense that, like, we all knew who she was, which, you know, at the time was, is, I mean, frankly, at any time, is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, the book itself, let's talk about this book. So, okay. We have Crane, our hero, one of our heroes, and then we have Stephen Day, our other hero. And the book begins, I think one of the things that I was sort of instantly surprised slash startled slash like delighted by is this book begins with a bang, and it begins with a bang that I'm not sure would be found in 2025.
No, a lot of things in this
book. A lot of the things in this book are.
Yeah, I think it's right. So basically what we get is Crane is trying to kill himself, and his manservant, Merrick, essentially, like, stops him. And what we really quickly realize is that there is some sort of, like, bad magic around Crane. And he and Merrick had spent 20 years in China, had recently returned to England. And what happened is like, Merrick is basically like, we got to get a shaman up in here. I mean, there's something really fucking wrong. And I was like, what is happening?
Well, right? It's interesting, right? Because it feels instantly, like, yeah, at the very beginning, all I could think, you know, it's very difficult for me to, like, escape, like, intent.
Yes.
I think, like, when I'm reading. And so I had this moment where I was like, are you, like, is this, when they were like, it's magic, like, yeah, it's the right shaman, like, we have to find a shaman. I was like, is this for real? Like,
yes,
is magic real in this world? Like, is there's sort of this big question mark in your head as a reader.
Yes.
Like, what am I getting into here? Because I also, by the way, everybody, do not read cover copy, which is just chaos reading, I know. But, like, why should I worry about that? That's not my business.
My job is to just read this book.
Exactly. This author has a story to tell me, and I don't need marketing involved. So, there is this sort of question of, like, and Merrick kind of has the manservant. So Crane and his manservant have been in China for a long time.
Yeah, like like 20 years, really. Yeah.
And while they're, like, they've been trading, like, Crane has inherited a title after his, what we know is an awful father and an awful brother have both died. But we don't know how, right, when all of this starts. We just know, like, he's sort of returned to England. He's in the family home. And he has tried to kill himself.
Yeah.
And we know we're sort of, it's, you know, the POV here is so close. Like, you're really just, like, so, you're glued to his consciousness, right? And, you hear sort of the manservant sort of say, like, not again, not yes. again. And you're like, what's about to happen? Like, right. where are we? You feel dropped directly into, like, just
yes.
chaos.
Yes.
And so, yes, he goes. And then it's like there's magic. We need to find a shaman. We can't find a shaman because we're not where shamanism happens.
Yes, yeah, right.
And he's like, nope. The manservant's like, no problem. I think I know who I can. I know a guy.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is your job to know a guy. He's a factotum, yes.
So he goes off. He gets a guy. The guy comes in. And, okay, also important for you to note, Crane is... Name is Destiny. He's like the tallest person who has ever
He's
lived.
He's all legs. I mean, at one point, it like Crane literally like almost Ichabod. Says that. He like he's all legs, right?
Yeah. Crane like the bird.
Yeah.
And so he's like very tall. And in comes this like kind of pixie sized
oh,
like
yeah.
leprechaun. Like
yeah. And he's okay. So Stephen Day is like, you know, he's literally, I think, 5 feet tall. He's yeah. very thin. He's like wan and pale. You know,
he has his snaggle tooth. Yeah. Like fox.
His clothes are like really shabby. Mm-hmm. And also, this motherfucker hates Crane. And Crane's like, we have never met. What could I have possibly done to make you look at me like I am that terrible? And yeah. this is when we get the background around Crane's dastardly family.
I mean, fucking terrible.
Honestly, at points in this book, I was like, this is so evil that if I was not living in the time of this second Trump administration, I'd be like, too much. But I was like, feels
no,
reasonable.
There's a fearlessness to this book that yeah. I think comes with, and this is why I'm not surprised that it's her first book. Because there's a fearlessness to this book that comes with, like, I'm going to leave it all on the table.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the things that she makes the bad, like, when KJ Charles puts a bad guy on the page.
Yes.
You could be guaranteed this is going to be a bad guy.
Yes.
And in order for you to write a bad guy, and this is a problem that a lot of us have, myself included, you have to be willing to go there.
Yes.
And she is. So we discover that. We discover that Stephen has had this like wonderful family mm-hmm. and Crane, they came up against Crane's family,
Crane's father,
terrible yeah. father. And where everybody always had like cowed to this terrible man and like let him have whatever he wanted, Stephen's father stood up to him and couldn't win.
Yeah.
Like, and he was ruined. He like was financially ruined. Crane's brother, who is just a fucking monster.
Hector. Yeah.
Hector comes in and he like to punish Stephen's family even more, rapes Stephen's mother. She gets ill. There's no money for medicine. She dies. And then his father
yeah.
like dies of a broken heart. Right. And Stephen is there kind of in with the intent that he's going to say, no, I'm not going to help you.
Yeah,
fuck off.
Right.
But he gets there and it's a romance. And he's like, actually, I am going to help you because this magic is real bad.
Yeah.
Like whatever is in here is bad. And he keeps saying, he shows up at the house and he keeps saying like, there's nothing. He can't feel the house. Like he's like, there's no power.
Well, wait. So
here.
You're
there's
wait. No- whoa. Because you're still. We're still in London. Hold on. You're a little ahead of yourself. So we're still in London. And what he says is something here is trying to kill you. And he realizes that this thing, this Judas Jack, has been brought back from the family home, which is right where then they are like going to have to go. Like essentially, right. the source of the magic has been transported back from the family home. And so, in order to figure this out, we're going to have to go to wherever that is.
Right.
Right?
So before we get there, this Judas Jack, just explain what that is.
Well, this is the part that's, like, really interesting and where, like, Stephen becomes kind of commanding, right? So here you're, like, and I think this is also, I want to, like, talk about, like, so in physical stature, they are, like, night and day, right? And, you know, all of the ways in which Stephen looks kind of weak and powerless. But when it comes to dealing with this thing, right, that is like emanating evil and the way the Judas Jack works on Crane, right, is that essentially it is almost like infiltrating his mind making him like think these sort of like evil thoughts that then he directs at himself. And the only way you can escape them then is to kill yourself. So this is like this really clever but evil item that is like if placed in the home, and it has like a reaction. It's not going to affect everyone in the home in this case, and it takes Stephen a while to figure it out, right? It's impacting just Crane because he is like a member of the family. It's aimed at him. It's like DNA coded, essentially blood coded, I think, to him and his family. So anyway, he figures out that he has to like destroy this thing. And there's like this great scene where he like tells Merrick, like basically like you hold him down and don't let him go because this is going to be really painful and he's going to want to fight you.
Yeah. He says like break his arms if you have to.
I was like, whoa, it is so intense.
About to happen is bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And so then he sort of says, right, like he, you know, he kind of destroys this thing. And then he very also kind of quickly is like, where did it come from? And then he's like, this is what killed your father and your brother, right? Like they weren't accidents or suicides. Like this thing that you are the third victim, essentially. And so what it is he has to figure out. He's basically like, we're going to have to go, right? And Stephen, the other thing that Stephen is able to do at this moment is we kind of then like switch into his point of view, is that he can like tap into something that he calls the etheric flow, right? Which is just the idea that like magic is in the world. There is like sort of their energetic or energy properties in everything. And the way that he as a magician is able to like restore himself is essentially to like tap into this thing. So he had used some magic to destroy this Jack, and now he has to like essentially like restore himself.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out later that like one of the reasons he's so pale and wan and thin is that it, like a couple months earlier, he had literally like drained himself dry.
Like to the bone.
To the bone, like in almost to the point of death in order mm-hmm. to fight off like, you know, some other evil. And so, you know, it just it takes a really long time to sort of for a magician to essentially restore like their power. And one of the reasons that Stephen is so powerful is that he can tap into this flow. Other magicians have to figure out other ways to restore their magic.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yes. Anyway, they're like, okay, you know, he's like, we got to go. And the other thing that then kind of comes up here is, you know, Stephen is very curious and interested in Crane and Merrick, who speak it's called Shanghaiese in the right. They were in Shanghai. They speak this other language. Essentially, it's a way that no one else can understand them.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, how can you? Your father and your brother were so evil. How can you not have been involved in that? And Crane's like, I've been out of the country for 20 years. I left.
He's like, I fucking hated them.
Yeah, I hated them. They hated me. I got gone, and I didn't come back till I knew they were dead.
Yeah, there's one point where he says to somebody, like, if my father was still alive, I'd still be 5,000 miles away.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
So there's that.
Right.
This week's episode of Faded Mates is sponsored by 1001 Dark Nights.
1001 Dark Nights has been a really big part of my, like, romance reading for a really long time. Because what they do is they find great novellas, often by some of my favorite authors, in series where, like, essentially they're not going to, like, publish a whole other book. This is just a novella about a side character I really love. So, for example, Kylie Scott has some stage dive novellas in the 1001 series. And 1001 Dark Nights is shuttering this imprint after this year. Now, the rights are going to revert back to the authors. But if you do want them in this print form, now is the time to get them. So along with maybe potentially novellas you really loved in series you like, they also have all of these great bundles that you've been hearing ad for all year. For example, there's a Midnight Myths and Magic, a paranormal romance collection that has a Gina Showalter novella in it. There's, you know, a Uniformed Heroes and Bodyguards collection that has a Kylie Scott book, one of the Stage Dive books. And so this is just a chance for you to do your last minute, like filling out your collection of some of these favorite books in series that you might like. And if you go to their website, they have everything that's available, and then you can go to your preferred platform to buy them. This is just a great opportunity to be rounding out your print collection of your favorite 1001 Dark Nights books.
We're very sorry to see 1001 Dark Nights go, but we're extremely excited about whatever comes next from the people at Blue Box Press. And if you are interested in taking a look at the long, long list of 1001 Dark Nights books that are available through the end of the year, you can go to 1001darknights.com and check out the whole list. If your podcasting app supports it, you can click on the chapter title right now to be taken to buy the book. Thanks, as always, to 1001 Dark Nights and to Blue Box Press for sponsoring this week's episode. So they head off,
yeah,
to the country, which is, honest to God, that's all K.J. Charles wants to do in all of her books. Everybody yes. goes to the country, right? There's a house, like... You want to know if you're in a K.J. Charles book, is there a country house? Because if there isn't, are you?
Yeah. And it's and like that, it's like, it is really true. Like, it's a fascinating dichotomy. Like, where, who are you when you are in these different places?
Yeah. And the country also, it means something, right? Like, you're an English teacher, Jen. You know? Well, like, nature means something. A change, it, like, setting a book in
yes,
nature
right.
is doing a thing. So they head off to the country to sort of figure it all out. Like, what's it going to be up there? Who was it? And the big question is, who was it? Because what we know is,
yeah.
do we know at this point that
well, he knows
the father and the brother have killed themselves?
Yes. He's like, it was a warlock, essentially. Only someone who's practicing in the basest kind of evil magic.
Like bad magic.
Could have made this thing. And it's really interesting. We don't quite know why, like what, at this point you're just like, well, Steven's like, you aren't safe till we figure it out. But what we find out later is that Steven essentially is like the magical sheriff.
Yeah, this is a turning point moment, right? It's interesting because we don't find this out until the end of Act One.
Yeah.
And so, and I think this is structurally, I know that like a lot of authors listen to these episodes, these deep dives, and structurally this is an interesting choice, right? The basic plot of this book, the plot of Act One of this book is who did it?
Yes.
Right? Like, who made this bad little, juju, essentially, right? And how are we going to stop them from doing it again? So they've destroyed the item, the
Jack.
Jack.
Right.
And then they've headed off to the country. And when they get to the country, in come the birds. So the book is called The Magpie Lord. And it begins with a magpie rhyme. And then you get there and you're like, and then they get to the country. And Stephen is like, holy shit, there are so many birds here.
Okay. I would like to stop and talk about this at length. Okay. So Crane has first of all, it's really fucking funny. Crane has all these magpie tattoos. And there's
we don't know. Wait, now you've ruined it.
No, he knows about it because at the beginning he knows about the tattoos because they're like ripping his clothes off because the jack
or
whatever.
There's a magpie feather in the jack.
Yeah.
And he says, why magpies? And he's like, magpies are the symbol of the family. Yes. Well, let's talk about this.
Okay.
We have to go back to when he takes his shirt off.
Okay.
This is a romance podcast, Jen.
Sorry, we have to go back to the part where he takes
we're just going back before everybody pause. We're going to get to the house. But for some reason, I thought that happened at the house, but apparently it didn't. And so he's like, can you think of other... He's like, what about the magpies? Steven says. And Crane is like, oh, well, it's the family bird. And it's on the crest and it's in the house and it's, on the signet ring and it's, you know, all there, the magpie is kind of everywhere. It's like it's what we are. And Steven's like, okay, cool. Anything else? And he's like, I mean, the tattoos, I guess.
Now,
Sarah comes online.
Of course you did. What I knew it, as soon as I read this, I was like, this is where Sarah is going to be deeply invested.
Wait, repeat yourself, Lucian. What tattoos? Please clarify. And Steven also is like, what?
Well, because again, this is whatever year, right? Like, and you know, Steven's even like, you know, these are common. Only sailors had them. English yep. lords that are earls do not have tattoos. And he's basically like.
So he takes off his shirt. He's like, yeah, I'll show them to you.
This is the greatest scene in romance, everyone.
He takes off his shirt. And he's got 5 magpies mm-hmm. tattooed across his chest. Mm-hmm. And apparently, like, over the course of 2 years, he had this done. Mm-hmm. And he says, and there's, like, this question. No, Steven, before he takes off his shirt, there's, like, this question, like, how many does he have? And he says, I have 7. And he takes off his shirt, and there are 5 showing. And Steven says, I only see 5. And now, listen, the magpie rhyme begins, 1 for sorrow, 2 for joy.
Yeah.
Right? And he says, the other 2 are lowered down, 2 for joy.
I have highlighted this because I was screaming.
Oh, boy. So, and this is where we are, right? Like, and at this point, you're like, here is a person who I am safe with. This is an author who's going to give me a great time.
Yes.
2 for joy.
Right. So, also, like, a really funny joke at some point gets made where he's basically like, really kind of fucking weird. Your family name's Crane. And you're, why are there magpies?
Exactly. Has it never occurred to you?
Yeah. Like, what's happening here? So anyway, no, it is fucking amazing. But no, then they travel to the house and the magpie thing gets real fucking weird. Not only the actual literal birds everywhere, which I was like, I would like to just, like, rewind back in time and go back to our conversation with KJ Charles and be like, had you been watching the birds? What was happening in your brain? And what happens is, but also, everywhere in the house, it's, like, magpie carvings, all of the dishes,
statues.
All of the, like, everything's got, it's magpie everywhere. Shit everywhere.
Yeah. And they're in all the portraits.
Yes.
They're like, so they get to this house and Stephen is like taking it. He's getting the tour of the house and he's like, I feel this house is bad.
Yes.
It's empty.
Not
just empty of like people, but empty of like soul. Mm-hmm. Like there's just nothing here. It has. And
he keeps
saying through the whole book, he's like, there's no power in the house.
Right. It's dead.
Which is a problem for Stephen because he draws power. Like his magic comes from drawing power from all around him. Right. Like, and also remember, we're in the country. Right. Like we're in nature. He should be able to draw more power.
Correct. And
there
instead,
he could
there's
in
none.
London, but it's just it's a vacuum of power. Except there are so many fucking birds. And to the point where, like, he's even in a room and it's, like, dark. And it's not dark outside. And he looks up and there's, like, a massive skylight. And he's like, if that were clean, this room would be light. And then there's, like, a plop. And, like, the magpies just shit up there.
It's, like, constantly. Crazy, right.
And Crane, who's a big fucking dummy, is like, I don't know, these dumb magpies.
That's fucking weird. What are you going to do?
It's never occurred to this man. And then they're in the portrait gallery. And he's like, that's, you know, my dad. That's my grandfather. He's like going back. That's my great grandfather. And suddenly Stephen is like, wait, I know this man.
It's fucking great. Everybody, this book's
and
so good.
And he's like, I know this man. And Crane's response is, well, we look the same. Like,
yeah.
And he's like, no. And then he puts it together that multi-generations ago, this man was a magician, known as the Magpie Lord. And he ultimately, like, inherited a new title, Crane, and, like, passed it on. And so, essentially, there's this, like, deep magic in the Crane family line.
And in the household and in everything, right?
So, and, like, the Magpie Lord... it's known that, like, the magpies themselves, like, were they were his familiar.
Yeah.
And so here we are in this place. And, of course, Crane asks the exact question that we ask at the moment, perfect writing, right? Which is, does that mean Crane is magic, right? And he's like, it means maybe, but it doesn't, like, maybe not. Like, it's just, it's not a family thing. Like, but here we are now where this kind of like big question starts to be asked about, like, you know, where is Steven going to get magic? And then, of course, in your head as a romance reader, you're like, I know where he's going to get magic.
Well, now,
but
yes.
It's interesting because, like, it doesn't happen that way. She doesn't. She could have taken this easy way out where suddenly they discover, like, well, when they bone.
Yeah.
Like, then there's magic.
Right.
But she doesn't. This week's episode of Fate of Mates is sponsored by Lumi Gummies. Consistent, mellow, and super delicious, Lumi Gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-day de-stressor, a midday mood boost, or help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi Gummies has a strain that's right for you.
Okay, so everybody, I, as you know, have went to a concert this week. I went to see Paul McCartney, and I would just like to say that I think that is like a perfect situation where you would like to have like a bit of a gummy, right? Like you're just enjoying all of the psychedelic vibes of Sir Paul.
And Paul McCartney definitely has a gummy before he goes on stage.
I mean, of course, and so did I in the audience. And you know what? I just think like in the holidays in particular, right? Like there's just so much going on. And sometimes it's just nice to like be able to like be ever so mellow as you approach your holiday tasks or approach your concert going experience. So it was just like kind of perfect and great. Highly recommend.
Well, if you would like to experience Paul McCartney in a similar way, then we suggest that you find your way to LumiGummies.com. That's LumiGummies.com and use the code FATEDMATES for 30% off your first order. Lumi Gummies are available nationwide. And again, that's LumiGummies.com, code FATEDMATES. LumiGummies.com, code Faded Mates. Thanks to Lumi Gummies for sponsoring this week's episode.
This book has so much plot, so much really deeply interesting plot where like things are happening and you're just getting like bits and pieces of information at the exact right time to like sort of clear up things but leave you wondering about what's next, right? So all of the plot in the meantime, what you're seeing is that Crane and Steven are sort of like circling around in a really interesting way between essentially like, I mean, it's like a real power dynamic, right? So Crane is, right, like physically more powerful. He is a lord, more powerful. He, right, like, but there's also all these ways in which Steven is so much more like, I don't know, there's something happening once they're on like the case of trying to figure this out where he's like really kind of in his element of like sort of we are now dealing with things that you don't understand, but I do understand. Mm-hmm. And he's starting to realize once he sees that like the portrait, like whatever it is that's happening here is way bigger than someone just wanting to kill your evil brother and father. Like there's no way that this isn't like important or meaningful. And what mm-hmm. we start to understand too is that so, okay, remember I said that, like, you can get your good magic from, like, the ether, but if you can't do that, if you're not a magician, you can do that. The other thing you can do is tap into people. And so this is, like, sort of, like, when this, like, kind of starts to be, revealed. But this is essentially the very definition of a warlock, right? If right. you're using other people, like, people have power in them. And so if you can't draw power from the ether and instead you convince yourself that it's okay to draw power from people, that this is like this is being a warlock and this is like the evil. And Steven's job, like his magical job essentially, is to like find people who are using evil magic and stop them.
And we discover this once he's found the creator for
yes.
of the Jack.
Right.
Right. So they head out, they find the like witch who had put together this like wooden, you know, bad magic thing that was killing the family line mm-hmm. here. And she's dead.
Yeah.
They find that she is dead. But they do discover, like, he goes in, he's like, this is the wood she used. He knows, like, kind of,
right.
it was her. And then it sort of has this kind of quiet moment. There's a
yeah.
quiet beat, right? This is the end of the second act. there's sort of Crane puts it together that he's more than just like a normal magician. He's like a magician cop.
I can't remember the name of it. Like a gesticular or something.
Yeah, like he's basically out there to stop bad magic.
I'll be really honest. I saw this word and I was like, I bet if I was British, I would just be able to like say this word. But because I'm American, I was like, I don't know what that means.
That's not your business.
That's so not my business. Sorry, everybody.
So he's out there, right? So then there, and this is the end of Act One. And you think to yourself as a reader, you're like, well, hang on a second. Like, the mystery is sort of solved here.
Exactly. So smart.
And so where do we go from here? So we amp it up, and like it's amped up slightly because now it doesn't feel quite, you're not really sure, like, what comes next.
Yeah. And so we get two really interesting kind of scenes in a row back at the house. And one of them is essentially that, like, Steven uses his magic to essentially, like, make Crane go away.
Well, Crane,
because it's...
Listen, but it's actually, it's more intense than
that. Oh, yeah.
Because Crane realizes sort of right after they've solved the problem, he's not drugged or anything, but he's like high on like, okay, that we've solved the problem, right? And he's like, and they're like out in nature, and he's like, I know you want me. And he's like, I know you want me. Like, why don't you come here and let me have you? And instead of going, Steven is like, you don't want me. I'm boring. You're not interested in me at all. Like, we've never interacted. Like, we've never interacted in any form of interesting way. And now you want to walk away from me. And Crane is like, okay, cool. Yeah, I do want to walk away from you.
Okay, here's my question. To you at that moment, did you, like, immediately clock that something had happened? Or did it take you a minute?
That something had happened.
Like, I mean, like, it's a very subtle in the, you don't.
Oh, that he was trying to use Crane? Like, he was trying to influence Crane?
Yes.
Yes, because his eyes, his pupils dilate.
Yes, right, exactly. But so it's very subtle, everyone.
It is. If you're reading too fast, you could miss it.
And then the thing is,
perfect example, everybody, about how romance novelists use eyes.
Yes.
Better than anybody else in the whole business.
And then what happens is essentially again, immediately, with these neighbors who come over and are like, you want to come over and meet our daughter, Helen. You like her so much. She's so sweet and pretty. And he's like, okay, I guess if I must. So then you're like, wait, this is a very strong-willed man. What the fuck is happening?
Mm-hmm. And then he's like, hang on a second. I'm a strong-willed man. Yes. What the fuck is happening? And then he figures it out because he's also brilliant, right? He figures it out right away. And the way she writes it is like he's in his office or wherever he is. He's like in a quiet room and he's like thinking it through. And he has basically like convinced, like Stephen tried to convince him that like the almost kiss didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Like that there was nothing sexy between him. And he's like, no, but I remember, like, yeah, but I remember it.
Right.
And then he's like, wait a second. And he sits with it and sits with it and sits with it. And then he's like, oh, fuck. And he puts it together and he is furious.
You know what
and
I always think of,
he
Sarah?
Should be.
At this moment, okay, do you remember in the West Wing that scene where they just see Toby throwing the like tennis ball and he's just thinking.
And then he puts it together. Thinking,
and he puts it together. That's like what this scene right? You're just watching him think, like, what the fuck just happened?
I know something has happened. What is it?
Yeah.
And he essentially, like, they call this fluence,
yes.
Right? Like the magic of it all. Like, and so when he like storms into Steven, he's furious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Steven is kind of like shocked, but also really guilty. Like he knows he's done a bad thing. And he's also like, holy shit. Like he broke the fluence
so fast,
very quickly.
Yeah.
Like he's seen it happen before, but never so powerfully.
And I want to point out, at least for me, and I'm not sure if this was just because I am a fast reader, I found myself also at that moment unsure if the second person had essentially like accidentally
wrecked it.
No,
like too much.
No, what I actually wondered is, okay, so Steven had clearly done something to him.
Yeah.
Was it lingering? And then like essentially anyone who's like, no, you really want to do this, you'd be like, oh, okay. Right? And so like, does that make sense?
Oh,
so
you were wondering, were they magic or were they like,
yes,
just normal people?
Yes, who essentially like stumbled into like leftover affluence.
And it's interesting because I think Steven asked that too.
Yeah, and he's like, wait, you did what? Were they touching you? And so this is now, here we thought that he had
something else going on.
There's more bad people after you.
And then we find out the Rose Garden is haunted.
Yes.
By like a fucking giant monster ghost.
Yeah, of the evil brother of Hector.
Who everyone has been terrified of. And then you hear this crazy story at some point about how like at one, like Crane was terrified of his brother too. And like once his brother was just like messing with him and tried and broke his leg in a door.
Yes.
And like it's just the horror of this family is so, she does not pull any punches.
Right.
So there we are in the Rose Garden. He's scared away a couple of housemaids, and now they're there. And then, boom, here's the ghost of Hector, who, like, something is wrong with the ghost's head.
Yeah.
And they can't, like, figure it out. It seems like he's trying to hold his head on his body. And he starts to go after Steven, and Crane, I mean, he just loses it, and he hits him, and he knocks the ghost's head off, which is fun to watch. I love a justifiable face punching, obviously, even when it's a ghost. And then they sort of go, they're like, oh no, there's definitely like more at play here. And at this point, I, as a reader, I'm like, okay, this, interestingly, like up until this point, this ghost point, I was like, this is like a magic-y book.
Yes.
And then the ghost came in and I was like, oh no, we're like in a...
Yeah, this is something way bigger. Yeah,
I don't know what kind of book this is anymore. Like it's bigger than magic. There's like ghosts and stuff.
You know, okay, everybody, this is like a really interesting book in terms of the romance pacing. And so what I want to talk about is like, this is where, right, like their initial interactions, like Crane can really, like Crane's into Steven and can tell that Steven's sort of into him. And after, like, sort of figuring out, like, the fluence, right, like, what Steven had done to him, Crane essentially, like, kind of, like, pushes them around a little bit in, like, a sec, like, you know, like, he's kind of, like, it's sexy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically, like, you know, he's kind of, like, licking at him, literally, and, you know, kind of kissing him and, like, you know, like, whispering right in his ear, right? Like, really using the attraction between them. And what he says is like, right, when I fuck you, Mr. Day, it will not be briefly. It will be long and hard and extremely thorough.
Yeah.
And, right, like, Steven, you can tell, is, like, really into it. And then we, like, get his mind, like, kicks back in. And he's basically like, your father ruined mine. Your brother assaulted my mother. And you think I'm going to let you have me? Like, get off of me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really then this moment where Crane feels, it's been very interesting to see him, you know, he's like, what is my guilt and or responsibility to these awful people that I, and he says, like, I don't think of myself as part of them, but of course you do. You know, I thought you didn't, but of course you do. Everyone does. It's why I hate being here. And in fact, all he wants to do essentially is like go back to China, where he's been happy and comfortable and can be himself, right? Like at some point they end up talking about how essentially like there's no there's like literally no problem with like men taking other men as lovers. And so he like grew up in a, you know, and lived in society where he's, you know, the English shame of all of this, he just literally doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found myself then like thinking like it's really a really smart way to like kind of put the brakes on at this point, because it, you know, if the way that Crane's family has ruined Steven's family is like this physical destruction, of course I'm not just gonna let you fuck me, right? Of course not. And so and there's limited sort of trust between them, although it is getting there, right? Like the sense that Crane is like, I think Steven at one point he says like, that's not an apology or an explanation, and I deserve both.
Mm-hmm.
right? And Steven's kind of like, shit, you do. Because the thing we start to realize about Steven is he, like, the one thing he feels like he has is the one thing about him that is, like, rock solid is his reputation and his knowledge of what is right and what is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so to have Crane, who he thinks of as coming from the most dastardly family in England, call him on that, right? I think it's like a moment of, like, really profound, like, kind of respect building between them.
Well, and there's this great moment where it's juxtaposed by, so pretty quickly they discover, like, so now we're in act two, like, we know there's more happening. Like, there's something even, almost even worse than, like, whatever the like, talisman was doing that's going on. And they go back, they go to, like, town. And this is where they realize, like, just how, and Steven realizes just how awful this family has been. And the town has turned on Lucien.
Yes.
Right? So you have this sense that, like, Lucien has come, he's been 20 years away, but the town doesn't know that, like, he's a good Vautry and all the other ones are bad, right? Like, the town is just like, he's a Vautry and we need to eradicate them, because Hector and the father have never been kind, right?
I mean,
that's a very, like, milquetoast way of saying what's happened, right?
Yeah.
So it becomes revealed that the person who created the Jack did it as vengeance for her own
granddaughter, I think.
Granddaughter.
Or niece. Yeah, something.
This is where it starts to get complicated,
right?
Because it turns out that there have been multiple instances of rape at the hands of Hector that the father was told about and did nothing about, and that resulted in two illegitimate children and also, I mean, like, incest, incestual rape. So, I mean, brutal, right? Like, this is one of those things where, like, again, the fearlessness of 2013 is showing its teeth.
Yeah.
Right? This is a really harrowing and horrifying plot point that shakes us as readers and Steven and Crane really to the core, right?
Yeah.
And Crane suddenly realized, Crane is sort of like, I knew my father and my brother were this bad, right? Like, but Steven is like, oh shit. And then Steven sees the townspeople's desire for Lucien's death, for Crane's death, and, like, for Crane's punishment through a sort of new set of eyes, right? And suddenly he realizes, like, it is his job not just to, like, figure out who's doing bad magic, but also to protect Crane, who is trying also to do better, to, like, be more than his, like his family. And he steps in this moment and he, like, does his Jedi mind trick to, like, the townspeople.
Yeah. Well, and to, like, essentially, like, the one woman who created the Jack is dead, but there's, like, kind of a new magical practitioner. And so, like, right, he essentially has to convince her to stand down, right? Like, essentially, she will be the one who's, like, focusing all of the evil magic potentially and aiming it, right? Like, so he has to, like, quell everybody. And the thing that is honestly really, I'm just going to say, like, right, this book was written in 2013, but I found it really quite meaningful to me in my life now, and, like, the experience I'm having in the world as an American, right? And what he says is, like, essentially, like, you didn't do anything about it until it impacted your family. Other families suffered at Hector's hands, and you didn't do anything until it hurt your family, right? And then you tried to kill somebody, right? Crane, who'd had nothing to do with any of it. That's not justice. And then he says, like, essentially, like, there were lawyers, there were guns, there were any number of things that you could have done to get rid of 100 of Hector's. The only possible conclusion is that you all liked having him around. And it's, listen, it's devastating. It's mm-hmm. like, you can't just passively bear evil.
Mm-hmm.
You have to try and do something that is right. You can't just like be evil in response to evil. And I was very, I don't know, I just was like, people, I, you know, there's truth in fiction, I'll say. I found this entire conversation about how we deal with the evil that surrounds us to be very powerful.
And yes.
For where we are now. I'll just say
and
that.
And in this moment, he defuses the bomb and they leave. And what's interesting here is, so we're deep in the second act. Like the writing here, she has now introduced all the suspects.
Yes.
Right? Like the second act is a murder mystery, like Agatha Christie style. And so now we have all these like possible suspects. We know all of them have sort of motive.
Yes.
We know many of them have skill. And we know that there's still more that's not being clearly, that hasn't been clearly uncovered. We get back to the house. And this is where he chokes on the hair.
Well, they go to the dinner. That's when they meet the final set of suspects, right? They do have to go to the dinner.
No, he chokes on the hair before the dinner, though.
No, it's after.
Does he?
Yes. So they go. Remember? Okay. So Sarah.
No, I don't remember. I mean, I read it. I read it yesterday, and apparently, I don't know.
Well, because that's like we're so used to books not having plot anymore. Okay. Sarah's right. So Sarah's like said, we met all the suspects, and she right. The last set of suspects were the people at the dinner, right? The two people with the daughter. The daughter is really
yeah.
right. And right. So then, and there's also like the vicar who refused to bury the girl in the cemetery who killed herself. That was the,
right. This is the big thing.
That yes.
There's the child, the woman who killed herself and who was pregnant.
Yes.
Was buried outside the church grounds.
Right.
Because suicide is a sin.
Yeah. And so this is like the last, right? So as Sarah said, like we've met all the suspects now. Like we go to the dinner. Steven can tell that there's something up with these people, right? Like Crane is being very, like now we see Crane back in power, like throwing his weight around, right? Like you're going to rebury this girl essentially inside the church grounds. And then again, they go home, right, from this dinner where the family clearly was going to try and influence him again to like marry this daughter. And I will say, far more upsetting to me, and I don't know what this says about me, the scene where he's choking on the hair than when he tried to kill himself, because it was
so horrifying.
He starts like almost like he's coughing up a hairball.
He's choking on hair, and it's growing in his throat. And Steven immediately knows what's going on and like gets in there and like gets it out, and then it immediately comes back. And he's like, you've been cursed. Somebody's taken a piece of your hair and is trying to kill you in such a way that no one will really notice, like that you died in like some kind of strange way. So he reverses the spell, and like the theory is that he has like singed whoever it is.
Oh yeah, like he sent end. Exactly. He sent the yeah, magic he, like, back
shot
through
the fire straight through the hair to the other side.
It's amazing writing.
It's very clever. It's a very clever little scene. It's also very like intense, and like there's a sort of edge of romance.
Oh yeah.
Here. And what I want to this is where I want to talk about the romance of this book, because for the first kind of like half of this book, I would say,
yeah.
like the romance is real light touch. Like, in fact, I would say for the first quarter of this book, there's almost no evidence that this
will be a romance.
This
yeah.
is going to be a romance. Like, it could just as easily be like a buddy cop.
Like or straight kind of gothic, right?
Yeah, like just sort of like a mystery with like a detective, and you know, they just figure it out together. And then there are these kind of very subtle shifts in character through the first act. And then there is a moment kind of early in the second act where it becomes clear, like, this is going to be, like, hot. And it is when Crane gives Steven a, like, very quick and very dirty blowjob. on the side of the road.
Yes.
In nature. And it's like hot and terrific and like half a page long.
Yes.
Because you're like, and again, pacing is really interesting here, right? Like they're in the middle of public. Like anybody could walk by. In fact, someone does. Two people do. And it becomes clear that Stephen can also like basically hide them.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
He can sort of vampire glamour them away, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, very handy. And then even, and I think I said out loud, well, that's handy. And then Crane was like, oh, this is useful.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But then at this point, you're sort of in the second act. There's a lot of discussion about like, it's very clear that these two are hot for each other.
Yeah.
And, but Stephen, remember, thinks this house, there's something wrong with this house.
Yeah.
And like, there is a kind of genuine sense that like sex is so personal and so bearing mm-hmm. for a person that he is like nervous about going to that emotional space by him, like in this house.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's the instinct that you have as a reader.
Yeah.
Because Crane is like, let's do it.
Yeah.
Get it on. Anywhere you want. You pick. Right? And Stephen is like, not in this house.
Yeah.
Like, not here. And so, and I think part of it is that I think there are a lot of things that are like not really said, but are implied in mm-hmm. the text about the way Stephen thinks about sex.
Yeah.
Through all of this, I think it's so deft and it's so careful. And it also has a real echo of like old school gothic romance.
Yes.
Where like the sex is there, but it's all shrouded, like the sort of thoughts about it are all like couched in non-sexual things. And what I mean by this is, for example, like I am certain that Stephen has never been in a situation where sex did not feel draining.
Yes.
And that his concern about sex in this house that has no power
mm-hmm.
is that it will drain him and he won't be able to have the power that he needs when he is inevitably going to have to use it because there's bad shit happening all the time. He doesn't say this. He doesn't articulate this like clearly, but it's just so odd. Like the character work here, the plot work, like the fact that as a reader, you fully understand this without a character having to say it out loud. Like, I've been thinking a lot recently about all this discussion, and I think we talked about it on the podcast about how TV writers are having to write for two screens now. I don't know if we talked about it on Banter or on the podcast, but like, just to recap, there's this kind of theory that TV writers are basically being told like focus is being divided, right? Like you're sitting, you're watching TV, but you're also on your phone. And so the dialogue in the book, in the text has to be you have to repeat things. Characters have to repeat stuff.
Or say what I'm doing because you can't.
The plot has to be sort of dumbed down to the point where like you can follow it with half an eye, right? And I was thinking about this particular work, like the work of Stephen plus sex in this book. And the fact that K.J. Charles explains it all to us without ever having to put the words in his mouth.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point, right? Because, and the reason it's draining is not because he doesn't enjoy it, but because he's so afraid. What if someone sees us? What if I get in trouble? What if someone, you know, I mean, I am already on the edge. I can't afford to be fined or put in jail, right? Like I cannot be cast out of society, right? And that's mm-hmm. what will happen. And Crane is instead on the absolute other side of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's basically like, if you've been gone for 20 years, how does everybody know your bad reputation? And there's this great scene where Crane's like, well, I was expelled from five schools, three of them for gross immorality. My father is happy to tell everybody about why he was getting rid of me. But, you know, there's no laws against it in China. So I lived as I chose and like word got back. And Stephen is like, no laws? Like, what? How is that possible?
Well, Stephen, right. Who runs his whole world by laws.
Exactly.
Who is law,
right? And I think that, and he's just like, and he says that, right? Like, no laws, you mean like normal? And he's like, yeah, entirely normal. It doesn't matter. None of it matters. And that is then why Crane is just completely like, he's like, after 20 years in a sane country, if I'm arrested, Merrick will bail me out and we'll go back to civilization and that'll be fine. He's not afraid. He does not live in fear of the law coming down on him the same way that Stephen does, as you said, is the law. And so, yeah, I think that is entirely correct. Like the draining aspect of it, the fear, right? All of the ways that he's been told it's shameful. Crane just does not have any of those things.
No.
And it's really... And the other part of this, though, is like in conjunction with this information, he also, like when, you know, Stephen tries to explain like what the ether is, right? Like essentially Crane's like, oh, yeah, like chi, you mean?
It's chi, yeah.
And he's like, what? And he's like, yeah, it's like totally a normal thing everybody talks about in China. Like it's not something you would hide. Why are you hiding something that... Right. So it's like everything about them and the way they operate in the world is completely opposite. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So and it's like that's when you see. Right. Like, why is Crane so fearless? Because he has lived away. He's, you know, and he's lived away from his parents. We also get this really terrible sort of moment where Merrick essentially reveals that, like, he was put on the boat to take Crane to China. And was essentially told by Crane's father, like, knock him overboard. And then when you get there, you can just, like, make your way and do whatever you want in the world. He's, like, paid Merrick essentially to kill his own son. Mm. So, I mean, like, the pure, like, the evil. And I think that's the thing that's also just really interesting in the book, right? The evil that exists in the world feeds on itself. And mm-hmm. so then you really are, I was found myself very interested in what essentially Crane and Stephen were able, and Merrick, right, were able to build for themselves in terms of like, but what does it mean if instead like love is what, right? Mm-hmm. The positive good ways that we can take care of each other.
Yeah.
Right? Justice, yeah. Right? Like it really is very much like these two big ideas just like banging into each other for the whole book.
Then we get into the third act, and I don't want to dwell on, right, like, everything that happens in the third act, because it moves, the pace is a gallop at this point.
Oh, God,
right?
It's so good.
We figure out who all the baddies are.
Right.
We figure out what they're trying to do. There is a battle, like, a full-on magical battle that they, like, prep for.
Yeah, it's great.
But there's, I want to speak about the magpie bit, right? So, as they're preparing for it, basically Stephen knows. He's like, they're too powerful. Like, I can't fight them alone. He sends Merrick off to find another person who he thinks, like, if you bring her here, she might be able to help me. Like, then at least I would have, there would be two of us. Right? And then Crane does this beautiful thing where he's like, here is, like, it turns out his signet ring was passed down from the original magpie lord, the magician, who was multiple generations before. And he says to Stephen, he's like, you need this. Like, this should be yours. And of course, Stephen is like, I couldn't possibly. It's the magician's ring, whatever, whatever. And he's like, you deserve it. Like, you use it. And it was like, there's this sort of moment where there's sort of a hope that this ring will be a talisman, right?
There'll be magic in it.
Somehow help channel the magic and help. And then, through all this, Stephen is sort of noodling these birds and like, maybe there's something about the birds, like something's going to happen with the birds, like the birds have power, like
what's
whatever.
Going on here? Yeah.
And of course the birds do. And there is the birds. Listen, this is KJ Charles is not a dummy. Like she brings the birds back. The birds have a huge role in the third act. Right. And then finally, these two babies get to fuck.
Well, they've like, but you know what's really interesting, and I want to talk about this because I found myself thinking it would have been really easy to have them do it beforehand.
Yeah, night before, right. Danger bang.
This is our last chance. But they
one
don't.
One night before we die,
right? Because Steven's like, I can't. I protect
you, do it.
And I can't do it because it's my all job to protect you, and that we can't do it. So I found myself. So they have to vanquish all the evil before they can.
Yeah. And then they finally, which is an interesting choice, right? Because we're, and I mean, like, listen, I'm a pretty big stickler, I would say, with romances that, like, I don't actually think sleeping together needs to happen after, like, the end of the, like, after the happily ever after, right? But in this case, it is so essential because the two of them, so you know, whatever, there's this big battle, they do win. Of course they win, right? And it resolves itself in sort of a very gory, kind of like,
oh,
horror-y
yeah,
kind of way.
Yes.
Right?
Leaning hard into the gothic at that
yeah,
point, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then these two babies get to finally be together, and they have sex, and it's so great that literally it wakes up the house, like, Encanto style, everyone. And, like, the whole house, all the magpies start to, they come to life.
In the paintings, on the walls, in the dishes, like, right, like,
and on Crane's body.
Oh my God,
they
it's
start
so
to fly
fucking
around.
Hot. Amazing.
And there's a moment, you guys, if you haven't read it, just skip this because it's worth skipping and like not spoiling. There is a moment, so, and Stephen's hand is on Crane's chest, and a magpie flies from Crane into Stephen's skin, like on across his hand and up his arm. And it is so hot. It's like the hottest thing I've ever read.
It is the hottest. I'm like, I want to bang on a table. It's so great.
The two of them are so full of joy in this moment together that like it feels like pure distilled happily ever after.
It is perfect.
It is. I mean, like, I'm not sure. It's interesting, right? Because I think historicals especially, romance, a lot of romance, but historicals especially kind of trade in like the agony of love, right? Like the brutal, like, I might lose you. This might never work. We might never happen. Like they can't be together kind of love, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I love that shit.
Sure, me too.
But I think that it is so rare in romance to find like pure joy between two characters when it is like fully earned, deeply believable, and like leaves you with this really satisfying sense of like, these two are going to be okay. And because of the joy, like, and I think it's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's amazing, everybody.
And I mean, it does sort of, and I like that. And they joke together, and like, you just have this sense of like the birds have like come to life and protected them in some weird way. And then is the moment of revelation where Stephen says to Crane, like, we together are the Magpie Lord. And then you're like, yay, now we're going to go fight crime. Get them a camper.
Also, he makes magical lube with his hand. So I just do want to say. Also,
oh, he does. And he's also, he's like a vibrator.
I mean.
Energy vibrator.
I was like, there better be some magical sex. It's perfect. So the end of the, yeah. So then here's the thing. The book ends in what I would call probably an HFN, right? Like, because they have just vanquished this big evil. Then, and this is interesting, right? So in my ebook, at least, it ends with like a short story, right? Called Interlude with the Tattoo, with tattoos, yeah. Where they, mm-hmm. we get more of the tattoo sex, which is.
Correct.
I could read every
which
morning.
Which is all I want.
All I want. And then it turns out that there are other books essentially with them, right? At, like essentially now kind of urban fantasy style, but like make it historical, where the two of them are together. And then like in every book, there is like a new big bad yeah. they have to fight.
Correct.
And so I am, you know, super excited to
Me
like
too.
Keep reading these because, God, what a pure shot of absolute romance perfection that book was.
Yeah. It was great. So fast, like so well plotted, so romantic. Like the end was so full of joy. I mean, just it really hit all of it.
Yeah.
I do just want to say one more thing about those tattoos. So obviously everybody knows I fucking love a tattoo. Like I love a tattoo in romance. And I, you know, tattoos like weather and color and animals all mean something, right? And birds are really particularly interesting as tattoos. They obviously were the realm of sailors. They have like a very clear meaning in this time period, which is sailors in the 1700s and 1800s who tattooed birds on their bodies did it obviously for freedom. Like it makes sense that birds feel like freedom. But also the idea was that they would bring you home.
Yeah, right. Right.
And so that's why sailors put birds on their body, like to bring them home
right.
to land.
Right.
And it feels like in this way, right? Like there's this perfect moment at the end with the bird tattoos flying between them, like there is home. Mm. And it is
so
it's
good.
Just lovely. It's a great moment. And yeah. I mean, that moment made the book
yeah.
in a lot of ways, like the joyful
yes.
consummation of their love.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would say this is one of those examples where we say all the time, like, there are all these rules of romance. And like, one of them is like, don't end it with sex. Like,
yeah, I think
and in this case.
Well, listen, the exception proves the rule.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say the other thing that was like really interesting is, and again, like, God, KJ Charles is so good at the job. Like, we like understand as the book like is evolving that Crane in particular has always been really attracted to dangerous men.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And it's almost like a shtick, right?
Too.
Like, he's always getting in trouble.
America's
and like right? Like, oh, right? And then he's like, what? And this moment, right, this man who is not physically imposing, at one point, Crane looks at him, and this is after he's, like, fought off all these, like, you know, complete dastardly evil, and one basically is like, there is not a man alive who would not, like, stand aside for him. That is, like, the extent of his power right now. And mm-hmm. so, like, that's the other part is, you know, really the fact that, you know, seeing this, it's literally a book that in every way is about, like, seeing beyond, right? Seeing beyond what, like, the presentation of a person into, like, what they're truly capable of, like, what lies beneath the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, it's so good. What a read.
A really great, just fast-paced, fun read. Obviously... just, I mean, a trailblazing author, we've already said. And please head, if you haven't listened to it, head over to the Trailblazer episode right now and do yourself a favor and listen to KJ just talk about the work, talk about how she thinks about writing, how she thought about editing, structure, the way she thinks about the text. That episode will be in show notes. We'll put it right at the top of show notes so that you can all find it right away. And... yeah. If you read this book with us, let us know what you thought of it. Tell us on Instagram, on Threads, on Blue Sky. We are on Instagram and Threads at Fated Mates Pod, on Blue Sky at Fated Mates. You can also leave comments on show notes at the website, which is fatedmates.net. I'm Sarah McClain. I'm here with my friend Jen Prokop. We are Fated Mates, and you can listen to us every Wednesday wherever you get your podcasts or at fatedmates.net. There you'll find show notes where we talk about, we leave links about whatever it is that we've been talking about on the episode. Also on all of our other episodes, we leave links and information on the books we talk about. And you can do that again at fatedmates.net. We are on social media. You can also join us on that Discord that Jen talked about at the beginning of the episode. You can do that by joining the Patreon. There are no levels of the Patreon. You just join at, you know, whatever amount you like, and you get access to one extra episode a month and the Discord. So that is at fatedmates.net/Patreon. If you're not in a position to be able to join the Patreon, but you are in the position to be able to have somebody who'd like to give you a gift this holiday season, you can get that or send them the link, fatedmates.net/gift, and ask for a Patreon subscription for the year. We would love to have you over there. Other than that, don't forget The Box, which is from Pocket Books in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. You can find that information at fatedmates.net/bookbox. A couple more episodes this year. We are taking the week off of Christmas Day, but we will be around for New Year's always with a very much headphones in episode.
Everybody. I already have
we
my
haven't
headphones
recorded
in.
It, but I'm already blushing.
I have been reading some things, everybody, and I'm just shocked. Shocked, I tell you. And you will be too.
And when we're shocked,
woo,
you know what's coming. So,
you don't know.
You have no idea.
You cannot possibly be ready.
Anyway, so that is us. We are very excited always to have you. especially now as the holidays approach. If you are celebrating, we hope you're going to have a beautiful, peaceful, very easy holiday season. And we'll see you next week. Thanks, everyone. Take care of yourselves and each other.